All right, last thing about atherosclerosis. One of the things that you have to realize, if you go in your own family, one of the most important thing, risk factors, is your own genetic makeup. Those other things like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, they add to it. Of those, barrel trauma, hypertension, is going to destroy your vessels. And during a break, just talking to one of your classmates about the whole issue of you can damage yourself by exercising too much, by the way. Biological tissues can only take so much stress, just like the fabric of your seats, the metal on it, it wears out. Biological tissues can wear out much faster. And so it's stressed. We have mechanical forces on all our tissues. Skin, bone, tendons, ligament, muscle, liver, heart. A heart's got to constantly be mechanically used constantly, otherwise we lead to hypoxic damage. Our blood vessels are constantly seeing kinetic energy being displaced to it every second. And so that's why you got to be mellow before an exam. Just relax, let the flow.
Does your mic have to be on?
Yes. No, that mic's on. This is just so you can hear me in the back. I'm loaded. I'm fired, ready to go. Electrons are flowing. This is already being recorded. Too many umbilical cords. So when we talk about four vascular beds, clinically, you're going to see, this is the important thing is, I'm going to go through and show you an example is, there's four vascular beds that are going to be prone to hypoxic injury or damage because of atherosclerosis. One, what's the most common disease to involve your cerebral vessels? Atherosclerosis. So it's a leading cause of a stroke. An infarct. Another important thing we're going to talk about in just a moment is what's the leading cause of death in the United States is ischemic heart disease due to atherosclerosis, leading to decreased blood flow and hypoxic damage, hypoxia. Another important is the aorta. We saw that. Most of this, what I showed you of atherosclerosis was occurring in the aorta, which is a common site for atherosclerosis. With or without rupture of aneurysms, for example, or that renal failure, destruction to the flow of blood through the renal arteries, or any arteries coming off the aorta can become occluded. Your carotids can be occluded and have a problem providing blood supply to your head. Then cholesterol emboli, because obviously the aorta. And then another important vascular bed is your lower extremities, those arteries. And they become damaged, atherosclerosis. And then if you're diabetic, have hypertension. So what I'm trying to show you is here are all the four possibilities. You're going to have patients that have just cerebral vessels and coronary arteries and nothing else. Some people just have the aorta, nothing else. Or another flavor, all of them are involved. So you got to always ask, so just because you see it in one vascular bed does not mean the rest are involved. Okay, that's the important thing you should remember clinically. But you'll see some patients, they got problems with their brain, heart, aorta, and lower extremities. This is what it looks like in the cerebral vessels. Here we see an aneurysm, and you see these yellow plaques in the basal artery, the base of the brain. And here's an aneurysm as a consequence in the subarachnoid space. So that could rupture, and you could have the worst headache of your life because of rapid expansion of the subarachnoid space with arterial blood. And you die. Because of this. There is the atherosclerotic plaque, and there's the aneurysm. Now let's go to the heart. There's the circumflex. And here we can see the atherosclerotic plaque is what color is it? Yellow. And what's left of the lumen? Right here. Leading to what form of heart disease? Ischemic heart disease. It's the leading cause of death. It's on the decline, but it's still number one in the United States. What's the leading cause of peripheral vascular disease? Atherosclerosis. If you have diabetic, you have hypercholesterolemia, you're smoking, hypertension, this is a consequence. Those are the four vascular beds. And we already went through the aorta. So that is hardening of the arteries. It's a chronic inflammatory condition initiated by what cell? It lives 620 days? Macrophages, see? Let's go, and then summary, atherosclerosis is what type of disease? Chronic over decades, affecting the elastic and muscular arteries. It's silent. Is it preventable? Yes. And but if you don't prevent it and you don't intercede, the consequences are what? Catastrophic. Just like hypertension. I've done so many cases of patients who died of the consequences of hypertension. When they say it's a silent disease, they're telling you the truth. And that's why hypertension is one of those conditions you really want to manage. And you want to exercise. I don't have hypertension, but I park my car purposely on the opposite side of campus. So I got to do what? That's right, every day. So I get to go through all the schools, see all these students, say, what are you doing on this part of the campus? I'm one of the few faculty to do this. Instead of parking across the street garage, make it real easy. Back and forth, back and forth. So that's why I may be running a little late, because I am running up the hill. Okay. Let's talk about heart disease. I'm going to give you four conditions. We're going to go over. We now come back to our circuit again. We're going to apply the four variables of what? Pressure, volume, contractility, and compliance. But now we're going to look at it within the heart. Okay? Now we're going to go to the heart, apply the same principles, and look at four conditions. First one, obviously, is ischemic. Now, as we go through each organ system, you want to use your anatomy. All that anatomy is not just for the summer and you see it during one lab. Every organ, you should break it down to its fundamental units that make up the whole. Then when you have a disease process that damages one or more of those parts, you understand what the patient and why they're presenting to you. So the heart has six components to it. That's the way I look at it. One, we're going to start from the outside, the pericardium. The surface of the heart, what's in there? Our coronary arteries. So that's going to be very important when we think of atherosclerotic disease or vasculopathies that affect the blood vessels. So the pericardium. The second is the myocardium, the contractility unit. That's going to be important as one of the four variables. The next is the endocardium, the lining of the heart. Very thin, especially in the ventricular chambers, but thicker in the arterial because there's less muscles, cardiac muscle in the arterioles. Then we talk about valves. Valves are critical. We have four valves. They're important to prevent blood going backwards. So if they become damaged in any type of disease, we got a problem. The next is blood vessels, the blood flow. And this can be very paramount to ischemic heart disease. And the last is the conduction system. Always have to remember that is a conduction system. It's an electrophysiologic motor. Therefore, if I damage the myocardium, what's a common complication? Arrhythmias. Real simple. Because I know it's an electrophysiologic organ, if I damage it in a number of ways, I can lead to what? Arrhythmias of all sorts, whether it involves the atrium, like atrial fibrillation, God bless you, or ventricular tachycardia, premature ventricular contractions, ventricular fibrillation, you name it. Okay. Now, what's another important concept about the heart? What type of cells are in the heart? The cardiac myocytes are what? Labile cells, stable cells, or permanent cells? Permanent. So if they get damaged in any disease process, what's the only choice you have for that tissue? To repair it with what? Scar. And now what happens to contractility if you now replace it with scar tissue? Decrease. And now we can lead to pump failure. And what do we call that clinically when you can't meet the metabolic needs of the entire cardiovascular system because your pump is failing? Is simply congestive heart failure. So when I hear the word congestive heart failure, it's what problem? A pump problem. It can't meet the nutrients and oxygen demands of the rest of the body. Yes?
But you said that there are four variables?
I said there's four variables for pressure, volume, contractility, and compliance. Then I said there's six structures, units, anatomy. We're going to do this to every organ system. As we go through it, I'm going to ask you or tell you to remind you what are the components. Some have four, like the kidney, the lung have five, the heart has six. And you can do this for any organ system, and then based on what the disease does to that structure, what should you see clinically? That's how you want to relate it, okay? So let's start with ischemic. So we're going to talk about the coronary circulation. This is anatomy. So we have two coronary arteries, the left and the right. The left gets divided, and it's going to be the main coronary artery that's going to provide the anterior septum because it lies right here on the surface, the LED. It's going to run on its surface and supply the anterior septum. Then we have a branch coming off the left main. Before it becomes the LED is the circumflex. What does circumflex mean? To go around. So what's going around? It supplies the free wall of the left ventricle. Then the right coronary artery supplies the free wall of the right ventricle and the posterior septum. And it supplies blood to the SA and AV nodes. So this becomes very important when we think of this distribution. And if you have atherosclerosis in one or more of these arteries, those regions will die due to an infarct, for example. Or have chest pain, angina pectoris. Or lead to a lethal arrhythmia and sudden cardiac death, which is death in 1 hour of symptoms. Two-thirds of sudden cardiac death is due to severe atherosclerotic coronary artery disease. This is another important concept. Where are the coronary arteries located? In what layer of the heart? The epicardium or pericardium, right? So therefore, as the coronary arteries go to the apex, it starts from the base and goes to the apex, it's going to give these epicardial branches, and then they're going to go into the myocardium. Here's the myocardium. Here's the endocardium. You notice they arborize it. So where's the last place to get oxygen? In your heart wall is the subendocardium. This is where your heart attack begins, or necrosis, or angina pectoris. This is a very simple concept. In any organ, I can tell you, I can predict where the infarction is going to occur based on the circulation within that organ. Because the heart has three places where it's vulnerable to necrosis of your myocardium. The first place is the subendocardium. Why not the endocardium? Because we get oxygenation by diffusion and nutrients to the endocardium and the few cells of the myocardium we call the subendocardium. This is where an infarct begins, and it can now go all the way to the surface. Where is the last place to get oxygen in the heart that's vulnerable to ischemic damage? Is your apex of the heart, because we have the base of the heart, where the coronary is, where the root of the aorta is, and you get the coronary, so the apex. Where's the third component of the heart muscle that's vulnerable to hypoxic damage? Is your papillary muscles. Those papillary muscles are the last place, especially the tips of the papillary muscles, and they can infarct. That's why at autopsy, we always open up the papillary muscles to look at people who are in shock. If they had some type of decreased blood flow, we look at these areas specifically looking for hypoxic damage. So the three places that your heart is most vulnerable to hypoxia is the subendocardium, the apex of the heart, or the tip, it's pointing always to the left, and then the papillary muscles. These are very important, because what's the function of the papillary muscles? It's the during systole to contract on the chordae tendineae to keep those tricuspid and mitral valves taut, so that blood does not go retrograde. Otherwise, you get what is called regurgitation or backward flow. So here's an example of a myocardium. Here we have coronary artery disease. There's the base. You see the aorta, and you see the LED writing on the circumflex. And if you had an atherosclerotic plaque more proximal, what dies? The apex. If you go in now, the second place. Here's that coronary artery on the surface. Where's the first place to die when there's a lack of perfusion? Subendocardium. And then it can go all the way to the surface of the heart. So if it's less than 50% of the wall thickness, we call it a subendocardial infarction. If it's greater than 50% of the wall thickness of infarction, it's transmural, going across the entire wall. Which is worse to have? Transmural. You got more myocardium. Okay? So it's a real problem. So these are the things you have to think about clinically, what's happening to the patient's heart. This is an example grossly to show you this. We take the heart, the long axis, the septum, and we're going to cut the heart in the short axis. So the right is the right and the left is the left. So here's the apex. Here's the normal myocardium. It's red-brown. But what do you notice about the color here? It's pale. This is a subendocardial infarct. And what do you notice about the amount of myocardium that's alive or dead here in the apex? Which is it more? Dead. So what are the two places we always think of? The apex and the subendocardium. And the third, which is not on the diagram, is the papillary muscles. This is very critical. When you think of what's going to happen to that heart, terms as a mechanical device, but an electrophysiologic device. We have to think of it clinically in that way. And there is the normal myocardium. And eventually, if the patient had survived, it would become what type of tissue? Fibrosis. And what color would that be? What color scar? White. And this, you can tell the difference. That's not white, is it? So this is the progression. What type of necrosis would I expect to see in an infarct? Coagulitic. What's the most common form of cell injury? Hypoxia. What's the most common necrosis associated with that is? Coagulitic. There we go. Say we reviewed for tomorrow. Get a double bang for the buck. So, what are the four flavors of ischemic heart disease? When you have a patient that has ischemic heart disease, there are four flavors we think of that represents hypoxic injury. One is angina pectoris, chest pain. You're going to have somebody who has stable angina. It means that they have probably coronary artery disease, but when they exercise or they're having sex, they're playing tennis, they're shoveling snow, doesn't matter what they're doing, riding a bicycle, pumping iron, and they get chest pain. That means there's not what getting to the heart muscle? Not enough blood supply to provide nutrient oxygen. They're getting chest pain. The autonomic nervous system is an effector system, but it does have sensory component to it. And that's why you get the chest pain, substernal. And sometimes the chest pain can radiate. That's more for a heart attack, but it's going to be angina pectoris. When they say unstable angina, it means that they're having pain at rest. That means they're what? They're about to have a heart attack. Because they have so much occlusion that's occurring, there's not enough blood flow, it's causing pain. Now, there's four groups of people that may not feel angina pectoris. One is women, because who tolerates pain better? Women, despite the movies. But they're changing. Next is diabetics. They get sensory neuropathy, autonomic neuropathy. They may not have chest pain, but they're having chest pain, can't feel it. Another one is heart transplant patients, and then the elderly. Because when you get a heart transplant, you denervate the heart and you won't feel pain. So MI was what we're going to talk about. Then you have chronic ischemic heart disease. This is a patient who has chronic replacement of their myocardium. They have no history of heart attacks or chest pain, but they're replacing all that myocardial tissue with what type of tissue? Scar. So what's going to happen to the contractility? Decrease, and the patient's going to end up with a pump failure or congestive heart failure. Insidious onset. You're trying to figure out why are they in congestive heart failure? Because the heart has been damaged chronically, leading to scarring. And this is another important term you'll see clinically is sudden cardiac death. The definition is very simple. You die within 1 hour of cardiac etiology. 2/3 of this is going to be due to what? Atherosclerotic coronary artery disease. Another 15 to 20% is a massive PE. Because if I obstruct blood flow through the pulmonary circulation, what happens to the volume to the blood to the left side of the heart? Decreases. No stroke volume. What happens to coronary perfusion during diastolic phase is decreased, hypoxic, and you can lead to a lethal arrhythmia. That's why you die acutely. Pulmonary embolus. So we talked about this, right? PE? Remember fluid hemodynamic derangement? I won't use abbreviations on the exam. It'll be spelled out. Don't worry. Just getting you used to the acronyms in medicine. This one slide shows the consequence of ischemic heart disease. Let's take a coronary artery. Here's a patient who has 50% to 75% of his coronary artery to that part of the heart. Doesn't matter, pick any coronary you want. And what happens to the lumen? One at the top. It's decreased. So what happens to oxygen nutrient demand? Decreased. So now if I'm exercising, what happens to your cardiac demand? Increases. Now it can't be met. Now they have angina pectoris. That's stable angina. Just based on that. Now platelets start to bind to it. Or what do you notice about the lumen now? It's even worse. What happens to perfusion? So what's the myocardium have? Only two choices. Either adapt or die. So the adaptive response is they degenerate and replace with scar tissue. Now the patient comes in with congestive heart failure of insidious onset. Now, what clotting factor would like to bind there, besides platelets, is Hagman factor. What do you form right away? A thrombus. Now, if I have that very quickly, a thrombus can occur within minutes or hours. What happens now with perfusion? Now it's rapid decrease. Now you can lead to unstable angina. The patient's just about to have a heart attack or does have a heart attack, acute subendocardial. Or depending upon how many vessels involved, you can lead to sudden cardiac death. You'll lead to a late lethal arrhythmia. Then if you have 100% occlusion, what's going to happen to the patient? No blood supply to that heart margin. It could be sudden cardiac death or what type of infarct? 90% of transmural infarcts is due to complete occlusion of a coronary artery with a thrombus over an atherosclerotic plaque. And so the signs and symptoms of the disease process can be mapped to the degree of what? Lack of blood flow. Because this is why it's called ischemic heart disease. Okay? So those are the four flavors. Here are corresponding images to illustrate one with somebody with stable angina. Here's somebody with congestive heart failure, chronic ischemic heart disease. Here's when it died of a transmural infarct. What's the most common form of cell injury? Hypoxia is everywhere on this campus or anywhere in the world. Doesn't matter. So coronary blood flow, it's got to be reduced up to 50-75%. You start seeing symptoms. And there's variability to this. Some people have very small coronary arteries, so it wouldn't take much atherosclerotic plaque to cause a problem. Some people have big bore coronary arteries. So this is a relative percentage, and depending upon, some people are dominant. They have a bigger right coronary artery versus the left, and some people have a bigger left versus the right. So everyone's special. So there's other variables. And it affects the epicardial and the coronaries, but not the intramural branches. The most common is the LAD. And why the LAD is branch points. When you have branch points, you cause eddy currents or disruption to laminar flow. Then it's the circumflex and the right coronary. Can you have all these and more branches involved? Yes. You'll have patients who have quadruple bypass surgery. What they're saying is all these major vessels are what? Have severe atherosclerosis. They have stents. They have 2-3 stents in those coronary arteries. So they have severe ischemic heart disease. 50% of myocardial infarcts involve a thrombus, whether you call it, you include subendocardial and transmural. If you look just at transmural, it's 90%. So what drug are people given if they have a known history of ischemic heart disease due to coronary disease? Baby aspirin a day keeps the thrombus away. Does it cure them of the atherosclerosis? No. That should have begun when? When they were your age. Okay. So, signs and symptoms of MMI. That's where we're going to finish up this, then you go on to the others. Chest pain. As I pointed out, what four groups of people may not have chest pain are women, diabetics, but they're still having a heart attack. This is important. The chest pain can be substernal. It can radiate to go down the left arm or up to your jaw. They can become, because there's a stress on the autonomic nervous system, you can have diaphoretic state where they're sweating. Because increased sympathetic tone. Another thing is, if the heart muscle is dying, what's the first cell to arrive when there's dead tissue? Neutrophils. And that's what you're going to see first, is increased white cell count. Then you're going to get electrophysiologic changes to the heart muscle. And where's the problem going to be? First, it can affect the repolarization. So what you're going to see is ST elevation. They call these STEMIs. ST elevation MIs. That's what a STEMI stands for, the acronym. Or there's a non-STEMI. It could be the QRS complex of depolarization. That's the problem. It's called a Q wave infarct. So you think of the electrophysiologic component and what part is being affected. One of the things is we look at a cell that dies, we can measure things that it can release into this system, the blood supply. In this case, we use troponin I. It used to be the creatine phosphokinase MB fraction, There's one for skeletal muscle called the MM fraction, or BB for brain. But today we use troponin, I, as the component. It rises at about 6 to 7 hours and decreases 4 to 7 days after the initial dead heart muscle. What are the complications? What do you think is the number one complication? Just without looking at this, what do you just think? You're affecting the electrophysiology of this tissue. Arrhythmias. 90% of MIs is arrhythmias. Real simple. What's another one? How much heart muscle has to die before the pump fails completely is about 40-50% of your heart dies in an infarct. You go into cardiogenic shock. Remember nachos? Neurogenic, anaphylactic, cardiogenic shock, when it causes an MI. Then you think of hypovolemic shock, then obstructive shock, massive PE, and sepsis. So we've got a little fluid hemodynamic range. Another complication is I damage the heart and the pump fails but doesn't die, so I lead to congestive heart failure as a problem to it. So those are three common things that you should always remember clinically when you see patients. Yes.
Can you explain why you see the elevated ST?
Well, if you think about it, what does the ST elevation represent? Is repolarization. And that takes active transport of ATP. You need it as an energy, and you don't have it. And so what happens is it becomes, on one side of the heart where it's damaged, it becomes elevated because of the consequence of that. It can't, and it gets has a longer on one axis of it. Okay. Now this is a diagram, it's to show you the clinical circumstances they're going to go through. When you start in the minutes when you have a heart attack, you're going from aerobic to anaerobic metabolism. So what acid are you producing? Lactic acid in the first 20 minutes. That heart is not getting enough oxygen. It's trying to pump. But that's reversible or irreversible cell injury? Reversible. That's why they put you in an ambulance and get you to the hospital right away. They want that reversibility. Then that reversibility is the first 20 minutes. But after that, it becomes irreversible. And what type of necrosis? Coagulative necrosis. So the coagulative necrosis is going to start and go and continue on. At 6 hours, what inflammatory cell comes in? What's the first cell to arrive when there's dead tissue? Neutrophils. The neutrophils will stay there, start to arrive a few at 6, and they stay there 3 to 4 or 5 days. What cell comes next? Macrophages. They start to come in, and you see the macrophages start to come in at 3 to 4, 7 days. And then what do you put around the dead heart muscle? Granulation tissue. What type of collagen is there? 3. Then it takes all the way up to 6 weeks to remodel it to collagen type 1. There's your 6 weeks. We've now gone through the whole process of cell injury, inflammation, and tissue repair. And who orchestrates tissue repair? There it is. So now we're just putting it in the example of a heart muscle that can't regenerate itself. Okay? So what drug do they give you in the first 6 hours? Is TPA, because what's in that atherosclerotic plaque you're worried about is a thrombus. Why not after 6 hours? Because the heart muscle is what? All of it is dead at that point. How much does it cost to give one injection in the United States of TPA? $25,000. One injection. That's how much they charge. So that baby aspirin a day? Not a bad deal. But you want to avoid getting it. So here the first part is wavy fibers. You don't have to memorize this. I'm not going to ask, but just showing you the changes. We see it's dead because we don't see what? Organelle. New nuclei. But we see it's the preservation is of the architecture preserved. So this is a coagulative necrosis. Here is a heart muscle, transmural. It's fresh. You can see it's the LAD. This affects the anterior septum and part of the lateral wall, the circumflex. And here we see what they call contraction band necrosis. And you see no nuclei, but you don't see any PMNs here at this point. So this is less than 6 hours. Versus here, what do I see? A whole convention of neutrophils at 3 to 5 days. And this sequence that's occurring. Okay. Then what are the complications? Because we have all those neutrophils coming in and releasing lytic enzymes, and the heart muscle is necrotic, which is going to be structurally weaker, it can rupture. So these can occur within the first 2 weeks of an MI, and it occurs maximally at 7 days, where you have maximal necrosis and maximal infiltrative neutrophils releasing extracellular matrix enzymes that are digesting the wall, making it even structurally highly compliant or structurally weaker and rupturing. Where are you going to see the rupture? Is the free wall. Which side? The right side or left side? Left, because it's under higher pressure. What type of infarct? Semicardial or transmural is more likely to give you rupture? Transmural, because you have maximum necrosis, structural weakness, maximally. And then where's another place? Is where does the vulnerability? Is the apex of the heart. What attaches there is a septum. It could tear away from there. Another place is, where's the third place that is prone to infarction? Is the papillary muscles. They're constantly pulling. And if they become necrotic, because remember, you get the blood pulling on the corded tendon, pushing the valve back into the atria, it'll rip or tear it right off. And then you have regurgitation, severe regurgitation because of that. Okay? This is what it looks like. Here you see the rupture on the surface of the heart. It's a laceration or tearing of tissue. When you look at it grossly in cross-section, here is the transmural infarct, the white arrow. There is the rupture site. See how it's torn. This is where it ruptured right through. And then here's normal myocardium red-brown. Well, if it ruptures, where's all that blood going to accumulate? In the pericardial sac. Remember, we talked about this in the lab. We went through that rupture. Here's an example of another specimen. Here you see the rupture site. This is the pericardial sac with fat around it. Then you see the pericardial sac filled with 600 to 800 mLs of blood. And so we know that fluids are non-compressible. What chamber is going to be affected is going to be the right side first. It's going to press on the right ventricle. It's going to force the blood that's coming in from the venous to shove the septum into the left ventricular chamber. What's going to happen to stroke volume? It decreases, decrease cardiac output, decrease diastolic filling of the coronary circulation, lead to hypoxia, and we've got a problem. Okay? And that's what a cardiac tamponade refers to. In this case, a hemopericardium due to a ruptured left ventricular wall due to a transmural infarct. Here's the papillary muscle that ruptured. You can see where they're supposed to be attached. They infarcted and just tore away. Complications, if it doesn't rupture, you can form an aneurysm because you have structural weakness. And it's going to be ballooning out, but doesn't pop or rupture. And it occurs more common than a rupture. And this is what it looks like clinically in a gross specimen. Here is the pulmonic trunk here. Here we see a coronary ostium of the root of the aorta. And here's the left ventricular chamber, and it's cut in half. That's why you see part of it extending. Here you see right here is the aneurysm. This is the papillary muscle. That happens to be the left atrium, by the way. That's the left atrium there. That's the mitral valve. And then you see, here's the normal myocardium. But what do you notice about this myocardium? It's become a fibrotic structure. And what could form in there? Because you have stasis of blood. A mural thrombus. It can now break off and become what? That's right. And that's the complication. So what drug do you think you'd put these patients on if they had a ventricular aneurysm? To an MI. Anticoagulant. Because you don't want that mural thrombus to occur. Another complication is mural thrombus, yes.
Why is it coagulative? I understand that it is coagulative.
First, when it dies. Fibrinoid necrosis is due to immunocomplexes or antibodies directed to a tissue and causing damage that way. This is ischemia. This is not acute immunologic damage like immunocomplexes, is it? That's the difference. When I say fibrinoid necrosis, what's the underlying problem? An acute immunologic damage is the injury. What is the cause of damage here? Hypoxia, non-immunologic.
Coagulative.
That's myocarditis. That's T lymphocyte. I'm talking about SLE, immunocomplexes, antibodies going to a target cell or tissue. Remember hypersensitivity reaction 2 and 3. Mural thrombus. So here's an example of this. This happens to be the heart opened up fresh. That's the aortic valve. You can see the coronary ostium. That's the left atrium. This is the left ventricular chamber. Here's the papillary muscle attached to the chordae tendineae, to the mitral valve. And then we see this big red mass against the wall. That's how big a mural thrombus can be. And you can see that could break off and become embolic. There's the aortic valve. There's the mural thrombus. Here's what type of infarct? Submucocardial transmural, just looking at it right dead in the center. Transmural, you can see pale infarct, and then you start seeing granulation tissue at the edge of it. Then granulation tissue, what do we see? Blood vessels. What is the growth factor called? VEGF, remember, vascular endothelial growth factor made by wet cell that orchestrates tissue repair? Macrophages. Then here you see the dead myocardium being taken up, because we see no nuclei, by macrophages at the edge and replace it. What type of collagen would you expect to see there? In granulation tissue? 3. Then as a function of time remodeling, it becomes scar tissue. What's the color of scar tissue? Is that white? Yes. And what does all scar tissue do? And what do you notice about the wall thickness there compared to the opposite wall? Right, because of scarring. What type of collagen is there? There you go. You're ready for tomorrow's exam. We just reviewed tissue repair. So we're going to take care of all these things. The names may change, but the underlying process is the same. And what do we call this? Fibrosis, replacement fibrosis. What are we replacing? The muscle tissue with scar tissue, with collagen type 1. Now, there's a problem here. If I've lost this myocardium, what does this myocardium have to do to compensate for the loss? What's cellular adaptation? Hypertrophy. Now, what happens to this hypertrophied heart muscle? It can now act as an ectopic pacemaker. Because what's the most common complication of an MI is? Arrhythmia. Now let's talk about rheumatic. What does rheum mean? Joint. Very good. That medical dictionary goes a long way. But we have joint and heart disease now. All right? Somebody likes fibrinoid necrosis, I can tell. This one is for you. This is fibrinoid necrosis written all over it. Because what do you notice? We have two organ systems that are affected. What are the two organ systems just based on the title? Joints and the heart. Now, we know it can't be ischemic because is there a lot of blood supply to a joint? No. I wonder if there's a little immunologic mechanism lurking in the background here. So, rheumatic heart disease is acute recurrent inflammatory disease that involves a pharyngeal infection, in this case, streptococcus, group B, beta hemolytic. And what this is a hypersensitivity reaction type 2. You're going to make antibodies to the streptococcal antigens that now cross-react to your cardiovascular system, including all three layers, your heart and valves. So this is a hypersensitivity reaction type 2, antibody directed to target cell or tissue. And if it goes chronic, we call this chronic rheumatic heart disease, we're going to lead it to what? It's like what type of tissue is going to the valve become? Fibrotic, because it's chronic. Remember the word chronic in any organ system? We always think of what type of tissue is laying down? Scar tissue. So this is the classic clinical presentation. When do you get this pharyngeal infection? Typically adolescence is the classic presentation. They get a pharyngeal infection. They have a fever. It goes away. But now because the streptococcal antigens are presented through the cervical lymph nodes because it drains your neck, that now you make antibodies to it. It takes 3 to 4 weeks to make antibodies, and certain individuals, they now cross-react and go to your joints. Causes a nonspecific inflammation because you activate complement, inflammatory cells come in, neutrophils and macrophages. It goes to all three layers of heart, cause damage there. It can go to your skin and cause the blood vessels in your skin to become damaged, as well as the blood vessels in your brain. So this is that antibody attacking those vascular structures. So this is, what type of necrosis would I expect to see in these tissues? Fibrinoid. See the difference between ischemic, coagulative, this is an acute immunologic damage. So here's the pathogenesis. Here you have a throat infection. Those streptococcal antigens now go to your lymph nodes. You're going to process it by your immune system to make antibodies against it. And now they cross-react to your various tissues, your cardiovascular tissues. Your valve, why the mitral valve is more common? Because there's more turbulence and injury to it. Higher pressure and turbulence. Then we get the fibrinoid necrosis within the endocardium, myocardium, or epicardium, where the valves. And this fibrinoid necrosis with macrophages and lymphocytes, we call this an Ashcroft body. And it can be on the surface of the heart, produces a pericarditis, inflammation of the heart, a myocarditis, or an endocarditis, or valvular injury. And any of those processes, chronically, what tissue is going to replace there? What tissue? Scar tissue, fibrotic. That's why it's called chronic rheumatic heart disease. Okay? Any questions? So acute, you're going to get these foci of fibrinoid necrosis because this is a hypersensory reaction type 2, antibody-directed target cellular tissue with macrophages and lymphocytes. It can involve all three layers of the heart. It can affect your joints as well, leading to a nonspecific arthritis, especially your weight-bearing joints, your knees, your ankles, hips.
Why the joints? I thought you said it was for more like vascularized structures.
But the antibodies will cause the blood vessels. There's around the joints, you have blood vessels there, and it's going to cause damage to the joints and cause a nonspecific inflammation to it.
What about other organs have blood supply?
It's the joints, primarily. It can affect the CNS, because 30% of your cardiac output go there, and the antibodies could go there and cause damage. Okay? Good question. It's weight-bearing, like the knees. Skin, it will go, your skin has blood vessels. It can produce, what's the color of the, if I say erythema, what's the color of the skin rash?
Red.
Because you're causing what? Damage to blood vessels. So it's answering your question. These are the classic sort of things to go to. So you have to think of it in this way. Okay? And it causes angiitis or inflammation of blood vessels anywhere in the body, but specifically these areas. Okay? This is what it looks like at the edge of the valves. You can see these vegetations at the edge of the mitral valve. Because that's where you have constant closure and touching. Then this is what an Ashcroft body looks like, or bodies. And here you see this fibrinoid necrosis and these inflammatory cells in response to it. So now we come to chronic. What is it going to do to the valve? Well, let's think of it. Your valve is the thickness of what? One sheet of paper. If you play with a sheet of paper, it's what? Highly compliant or low compliant? Highly compliant. It's got to last. Every beat of your heart, your valves are constantly doing this all the time. So which valves wear out first? The ones on the left or the right? Physiologically. Left, because there's what? Higher pressure and turbulence. The mitral valve. So if I'm going to have immunologic damage, where am I going to see it? On the high pressure side or the low pressure side? High pressure. Can it affect the right side of the heart? Yes, but not on this exam, not this, the second exam, but this is why it's mitral stenosis. Now it becomes fibrotic. You get thickened, becomes like cardboard. You get fusion of the valve leaflets, and you get shortening and fusing of the chorded tendineae. Because what does all scar tissue do? Contract. So it's going to make this valve very stenotic or stiff, impeding what? Systolic or diastolic function? Diastolic filling, because you're going to fill from the atria to the ventricle. So it's going to cause stenosis or impede flow into the left ventricle. What's going to happen to the, if you're stenotic, the blood backs up into the left atrium and becomes what? Dilated as a consequence of this stenosis or impediment to blood flow during diastolic filling. Then what can happen in a dilated atrium? You have to worry about what? A mural thrombus. Remember? Because blood flow, stasis of blood. Virchow's triad. Then what loves to live on damaged valves? We'll talk about this next week, is bacteria. Now you have to worry about infective endocarditis as a complication. This is what a valve looks like. Are your valves avascular or vascular structures normally? They're what? They're avascular because they're only a sheet of paper. Do you see blood vessels on that valve? That means it's been damaged. When you see blood vessels in a valve, it means it's damaged because they're normally avascular. So there's the vessels, but what do you notice? What's the color of scar tissue again? And what do you notice there? White. And that's been damaged. What do you notice about, does it look thickened, the valve? Yes. And then what do you notice about the chordae tendineae? You saw the heart when you see they're nice and thin like a puppet string, but what do you notice about these chordae tendineae? They're thickened, fused, and shortened, because what does all scar tissue do? Contract. Okay? This is another valve of the mitral valve. What do you notice about the chordae tendineae? It's like rope, isn't it? Versus like string. And so that valve is very thickened and damaged, and it's reversible or irreversible injury when it looks like this. So what's the only treatment for this patient? Valve replacement. Exactly. That's the only choice you have. That's it. Because it can't regenerate. So what's going to happen to the lung? It backs up the lung. You're going to get hydrostatic pressure, pulmonary edema. Normal lung is pink. This will turn bright red. You get infarcts. You get blood pouring into your alveolar sacs. Macrophages eat it. You get rusty sputum if you cough it up. The arterial side will have higher pressure and lead to decreased blood flow. And then the right side of the heart will have to work harder, hypertrophy, dilate, and then fail. Your normal lung should be pink, but what's this color lung? Red. This is passive congestion due to mitral stenosis, where it backs up because it's impeding blood flow from the left atrium into the left ventricle and backing up in the pulmonary veins and capillaries. So the last thing, mitral insufficiency, regurgitation. Here's my valve leaflets. They're stiff, but if they contract, then they can't close during systole, and now you get regurgitation. Can you have stenosis and regurgitation at the same time? Yes, but not on any exam you'll ever see. But in the real world, yes. It can do the same thing for the aortic valve, stenosis, as well as regurgitation. The last slide, as we break, you see you cause damage, fibrosis of the aortic valve, and that's the lumen that blood has to be propelled out of the left ventricle during systole. Is that going to impede the blood flow? Yes. And so this is rheumatic chronic heart disease. On that note, good luck on your exam this afternoon, and I'll see you bright and early mañana. Get a good night's sleep. No all-nighters. Promise? Good. And bring your medical dictionary, paper version. Good luck.
This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.